is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. The coronavirus outbreak ended the final contest of the National Lacrosse League season and the inaugural season of the New York Riptide.
Chance the opposite way. Here's the captain, Dan McCray. 1v1. McCray, bulldozer his way. Shoots. He scores! The captain, Dan McCray, lifts New York to the first win in franchise history. 13-12 over the Georgia Swarm.
And my guest on Sports Jam is the executive VP of the New York Riptide and GF Sports, Rich Lisk. Rich, thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
Thank you. I look forward to it. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you are joining us from your home in Lawrenceville, and you've been there for about 25 years, but I understand you're heading to Long Island soon.
Yeah, so when I took the position with GF Sports in January, and one of the things is that our office is directly across the street from the Nassau Coliseum, and that's where our business operations is set up for our entities. So I'm going to be heading up that office. So my wife and I, it's actually great timing. My kids are kind of out of school already. Two will be out. One's out last May. One will be out this May. And we were looking to move to Ocean City, New Jersey. And that's where we love the vacation and things. So that's where we were heading. And when this offer came up, I looked at my wife and I said, well, we could go 100 miles south to the beach or 80 miles north to the beach. So we're going to go 80 miles north to the beach and be in Long Island. So I'm actually been here. We're cleaning out, selling some stuff, getting the house ready to put on the market. The next couple of weeks or a month, whenever we can, we're going to put it on the market, and off we go to Long Island.
That's exciting news for you. And you've had some exciting news as far as your position. It's been expanded both with the Riptide and GF Sports. Talk to us a little bit about GF Sports. It's a live events and sports media entertainment company. How'd you get involved with them?
Yeah, so they've been around a couple of years, since 2015. I have a good friend, Sean Tilger, who's an advisor for them at this moment. And Sean called me and said, hey, we really want to talk to you about possibly a position. We're looking at expanding our sports portfolio and trying to get someone to wrap their arms around the whole sports portfolio. So we had some discussions. I'm very comfortable with Sean. I've known him for 20-something years. We both worked in Philadelphia for a while together. And when I was with the Titans, he was with the Flyers, and they were our affiliates. So I was comfortable there. I had a chance to go in and meet with Gary Furman and Eric Baker, the principals of the company, who were two of the smartest men I've ever met. And the way they've put together their business is great. And it was an opportunity that I just couldn't refuse. It's worked out well. We own the New York Open, which is a tennis event that happens in the February timeframe in Nassau Coliseum. We own the Atlanta Open, which happens in the July timeframe down in Atlanta. We just did a deal with the American Kennel Club, where we're doing an event. We did an event in February called Meet the Breeds, which went very well. And then we're going to take that on the road. We also own a company called Wolfpack Ninjas, which is kind of like a mud runner type event. So we have that we're looking to put on the road. And then the big piece of that portfolio is the New York Riptide, which is in the National Lacrosse League. And that's where I came from, the National Lacrosse League. I was in the league for about 8 years, two in Philadelphia, and then we were sold to the Mohegan Sun Casino in Uncasville, Connecticut. And I became I just transferred up there and was the GM of the New England Black Wolves. So that's where I think the promotion has come in a little bit. I'm doing a lot of the marketing and sales and management of all the organizations. And then I have the background of being a GM in this league, so I'm taking over the lacrosse operations side also of the Riptide. So I'm looking forward to the challenge. It's going to be really fun and cool.
Rich Lisk has had more than 25 years experience in the sports industry, and you had quite a run as the GM for the New England Black Wolves. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But this first year for the New York Riptide, unfortunately, like all sports leagues, had to be cut short because of the coronavirus. How disappointing was that?
It was disappointing. I got here after they've played a few games. I came, I won't say midway through the season, probably they had a third of their games done. So I was getting my feet wet and learning the personnel and learning how they operate and stuff. And then when you just kind of try to hit your stride, like I when I got here, we revamped the business side of things. We were selling tickets. We had our best revenue generating game, our best attended game. The team was starting to play well. And then we get hit with this. And this is the stuff that's out of the blue. And you didn't realize this was coming. So very disappointing on that part. But also, I'm the eternal optimist, and the glass is always half full with me. So I look at this as an opportunity for us also. There are some things we needed to fix. There are some things we need to improve on. And now this has given us the opportunity to do that. The team itself on the floor, we went 1-12. And we were officially eliminated from the playoffs before the pandemic hit. So in reality, this started my off season a month earlier. And now we can put some things in place to really come out of the gates when this is going to end, or when it gets close to ending. Because I do believe that I think the event business and the sports world is going to change. There's going to be a new norm. And this gives us an opportunity to really get out in front of that. Our season won't begin next year till December, so we can see a lot of things that are going to happen before us with other sports leagues, improve on what they're doing, learn from their mistakes, but also it allows me to put the processes in place, and it allows me to set the staff, and it allows me to get things done that we would have probably had to wait 3 or 4 more months to do. And now I'm way out ahead of the curve with that. And it allows us, again, to wrap our arms around our other entities and see how we can cross-promote and work together on all those things and make it one cohesive unit. So if there is a silver lining in this whole part of it, I think it's a silver lining for GF Sports that allows us to reset and really set a plan in place for the coming of what's going to happen now after this pandemic is over.
What do you think the new norm will look like?
You know what? I think it's going to be different, right? I mean, people are still going to be a little scared of being in big crowds. And I think until you get that vaccine, and I'm not a scientist, I'm a sports marketer, but when that vaccine comes, I think it'll ease up some things. I think people wear masks. I think people with the sanitizers, and there will be some sort of social distancing and things. So we're looking at every aspect of that for our business. We're looking at masks for all of our season ticket holders, all of our ticket buyers. We're looking at hand sanitizers for all of our ticket buyers. We're even looking at possibly, you know, you sell 4 seats, leave 3 seats open, sell 4 seats, and put that social distancing. We're looking at selling row A, not selling row B, and selling row C, and setting it up like that. So I think somewhere there's going to be a variation of all of that. I just don't think we're going to open the doors and 10,000 people are going to come crashing through those doors right away. I think we're going to have to ease some of the people's minds. I think we're going to have to ease them into it, get them comfortable, get them understanding, get our staff comfortable and understanding, get our players comfortable and understanding. So I think there's going to be a lot of that learning curve. And I do think there will be some new things coming out of this, like post any tragedy that happens. Things they're new, what we consider quote unquote new norms. I've talked to our concessionaires, and some of the things they talk about is more prepackaged foods, less handling of food, less condiment, no condiments. Like your condiments will be prepackaged and handed to you, and not like a mustard squirter and a ketchup squirter anymore out on the table. You know, little things like that, more canned beverages, more bottled beverages, so less fountain sodas, things like that, that will be considered kind of the new norm. So the good thing, again, silver lining, is that we'll have 8 months to look at all of that and put into place what works. And I think gradually you'll see what we get to, the new normal.
Being really a guru when it comes to sports marketing through the years, and so many different sports for you, Rich, what sports league do you think will come back first? Do you have any? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, you know, we've talked about that a bunch. And I think the ones that could come back the quickest are the ones that, one, have big TV contracts and rely less on ticketing. And not, I shouldn't say less on ticketing, but if you get a big gate, but if you're getting paid millions and millions of dollars for TV, that helps, right? It's not in our league, we're 60% of our revenue comes from ticketing. In the NFL, they have a $1 billion TV deal. So if you had an empty stadium, owners would still be making money off of that and making money off of merchandise and things. But we actually had this discussion a few weeks ago, a couple friends of mine, and I think tennis could be one that could come back because it's one person against one person. You can social distance them. It's not team. You're not banging into someone. You're not tackling someone. You're not sweating on somebody. So I think that could help. I have a good friend, and I'm on a sports business seminar tomorrow, Zoom call, and one of my good friends is from NASCAR. I think NASCAR could come back pretty quickly. You put a guy in a car, drive around the course, just keep going left, and it's made for TV. Golf, I think golf could make a comeback because you could do social distancing on a course with fans. It's a TV product. You could limit how many people play in foursomes. You can stagger how many when your foursomes go out and things. So I think those ones will do well. I think the team sports where there's a lot of people traveling together and a lot of people living together, that's going to be the ones we really have to look at and see where we go from there. But I think those other sports would probably come back, could come back a little quicker.
Before we move on with your individual career and some of the things you're involved in, how about the idea that Major League Baseball could be moving to Florida and Arizona? That seems something that we would never be able to really comprehend.
It's interesting, right? I mean, it's kind of the Grapefruit League and the Cactus League is going to be Major League Baseball. And it is very interesting because do you limit fans? Do you sequester the teams in hotels, families, things like that, locker rooms? There's going to be a lot more of that that has to be sanitized and done over. Like, we've even looked at that in our league a little bit. Like, we play at night and the Islanders play in the afternoon. That usually takes about 3.5 hours to turn over with. Now that's going to take longer because you have to sanitize the whole arena until we're comfortable. So I think with baseball, again, I'm not a scientist and I'm not a doctor and I listen to the news like everybody else. And I'm sure they're doing their research that says these two areas are probably places that they could try this out. I mean, it's working overseas and in Japan with baseball and they're playing in empty stadiums. But you still got the aspect of the players and you got to make sure that you take care of them and make sure they're in the right realm. So it's going to be interesting to see, especially because the NFL still has a little while here to go before they would kick off their season. Baseball's on the clock and they got to see what they can get done. So it'll be interesting to see.
Riptide now have an opportunity to go man up.
On the power play, it's Saunders with his second goal tonight. Back down to a one-goal game.
So if both teams can stay out of the box, they might put themselves in a better position here.
We're speaking with Rich Lisk here on Sports Jam, the executive vice president of not only the New York Riptide, but also GF Sports. In your role with the Riptide organization, obviously they brought you in after a successful run in the National Lacrosse League, but you've already done some things for the community that's coming up that is related to the coronavirus outbreak. Can you talk about the earmarking of the PPE and other equipment for hospital staff at Catholic Health Services?
Yeah, we're doing, we've worked with MassPath Federal Savings, and they did a really good promotion with us where they donated $5 for every save we made. And then this week, we're going to award $5,000 to Catholic Charities with MassPath, and it's going to go towards PPE and masks and things like that to help us, to help give back to that community. You know, Long Island has been one of the places that have been hit really hard. And Nassau and Suffolk County have been hit really hard. This is a little way we can work with them and work with one of our partners to do that. We're also working with Jersey Mike's, which is another one of our partners, and we're going to be delivering food and prepackaged meals to senior citizen homes that are having some tough time and senior citizen living centers. So we're doing that. We're working with Orland and Cohen, who is a big partner of ours and a huge proponent of us. And I use partner in the greatest sense that we don't have sponsors. We have partners, and all of our partners are working with us. And Orland and Cohen and I are talking about now where we would go to the local hospital and start feeding the shift workers and things. And we're just working out logistics and stuff now. And those are some of the things because Nassau and Suffolk County, Long Island, has been hit really hard, and we want to do our part to help out, too.
This shift that you've made to a team that, as you mentioned, did not have a good season, but marketing a team, you're already in the motion, as you talked about, learning on different ways to make this connect. But Long Island has embraced the Riptide, even though a tough start as far as the record is concerned.
They have, and it's been good. Again, I got here a little late. I wasn't here at the beginning when they launched the logo and the team name, and we set the foundation. So I got in about a couple of games into the season, I think three or four games into the season. So I had a little bit of a learning curve to learn the marketplace and things. But I've been very impressed, and one of the things I've been impressed with is that throughout this whole pandemic, we missed three games at the end of the season, and we had to cancel three of our games. So we had people's money in our hands, and we did an effort to reach out to every season ticket holder and talk to them. We had our players with our sales reps get on the phone and call them. And that call wasn't to talk about money, and it wasn't a call to talk about the games or anything. It was more of a call to say, hey, I've adopted Long Island as my home too. You live there. How's your family? How's everything going? What are you guys doing? And out of those calls, like, some of the parents were like, oh, our kids would love to get a message from you. So we sent messages from our players, video messages. We sent training tips. We sent workouts and things. And then the league canceled, and we had to pivot, and we had to call the people back and talk to them about, we have a credit here with you, and what do you think about next year, and we're going to play and everything. And I'll be happy to say we've been in about a week of that, and we have 50% of our season ticket holders have said, we love what you're doing. We love everything you guys are doing. We're staying with you for next year and stuff. And then we got a few more months here now to talk to the rest, but within a week to have 50% of the people step forward and be like, yeah, roll my money over to next year and let's do this. That tells me something. And that really tells me a great story that the marketplace has really taken to the team. I think another great thing, and again, I won't take credit for this because I did not do it, but I think they did a great job by having three guys live in the marketplace. We have three guys who live there, and they go to every high school and every middle school and every youth lacrosse tournament and every youth lacrosse practice. And we did an anti-vaping and an anti-bullying program where they were in schools 3 days, 4 days a week doing this. And I believe that those things really have translated to them creating a brand for us and creating this. Because lacrosse is a huge market in Long Island. We're now teaching box lacrosse, and we're introducing these players to them. And that was a big, big marketing pull that I think the owners, Gary and Eric, I tip my hat to them because that was a smart move. Not every team does that. And they did that. And I think it's really translating. And I'm looking forward to this second season because we're here and we're a hometown team and we're not going anywhere. And I look at Long Island as a community, and we're going to be the community team in that marketplace. And I see the steps being taken right now for that to happen.
What a resume for Rich Lisk. 2016 General Manager of the Year for his work with the New England Black Wolves. 4 years in a row, the team made it into the playoffs. He was the General Manager of the Philadelphia Soul of the AFL and President General Manager of the East Coast League's Trenton Titans that he mentioned, the affiliate of the Flyers. And you graduated from Rutgers University. Now, you played club lacrosse at Rutgers. And some people are saying, hey, wait, I know Rich Lisk. He was the guy who went to St. John Vianney High School and grew up in Union Beach. So you have always been a Jersey guy, and sports has been a part of you. When did you know that it was going to be the marketing side that was going to be your career?
You know, it's funny. I go to a lot of high schools and colleges and speak. And if I had to do life over again, I would have been a teacher. And I have a lot of respect for teachers and what they do and interacting with the kids. And I would have taught sports marketing and things. And when I talk to the kids about that, everybody wants to come out and play, and especially now in youth sports. Everyone thinks they're going to the NHL and the NBA and Major League Baseball and soccer and lacrosse, and they want the big contracts. And I grew up in a little town of Union Beach, like you and I have talked about. And I played Babe Ruth, and we won the 13-year-old Babe Ruth championship. And I thought I was a great baseball player, and I wanted to be the shortstop of the Yankees. And then when I got older, I figured I couldn't hit, and I could field, but I couldn't hit, and that wasn't going to happen. So what do I do? So I went to Rutgers. I went to Monmouth, actually, my first year for 1 year, and then I went to Rutgers, and I got into Cook College. A lot of people don't realize that I'm an old man, so Cook was an agricultural school at the time. So my degree was agricultural economics and finance, but I had a passion for sports. And I think that's really was rooted in me when I was a kid. And sports to me meant camaraderie. Sports to me meant family. Sports to me meant an escape. I did not grow up in the greatest of households. We moved a couple of times within Union Beach. I grew up in an abusive household. And after the solace that I got was on the field. On the field, no one could touch me. On the field, I was good. I wasn't put down by anybody. And on the field, I had a family. And so that got embedded in me very early. So I said, I'm going to make my life in sports. And when I got to Rutgers, I was economics, finance. They didn't have sports marketing at the time. And I had 4 years. I didn't have any more money. I was getting out in four, and that was it. And at the time, people used to go to graduate school or went to graduate school to get into program either in St. Thomas Aquinas or Ohio State to do internships to get into the sports world. Because in the sports world, it's who you know and not really what you know. It's who going to help get you in. And I didn't have that opportunity because I had 4 years and that was it. So I went to my advisor and I said, I want to be in sports somewhere. And at the bottom of our advisor page, she said, we might have an internship at Madison Square Garden. So I was a junior in college. I was 19 years old, didn't own a suit, didn't own any of that. I pieced together a suit and I took a train from New Brunswick up to Madison Square Garden. And I went through two interviews. I had the first interview was with the Knicks, and the Knicks said that I could cut tape. So if Patrick Ewing wanted to know how many rebounds he had, I was the guy to put all the Patrick Ewing rebounds on a tape. And I'm not technically inclined. I still have a VCR that blinks 12. So that didn't appeal to me. And then they said, well, we got this other one in Madison Square Garden boxing. And it's at the Felt Forum. So go down to the Felt Forum. So I walked down to the Felt Forum. It was in the basement of Madison Square Garden. And there was a guy sitting behind a desk and he had all these papers and it was no windows or anything. And he's like, we're the boxing department. We put on monthly shows and we have only five people that work for us. So if you want to be our intern, we will we'll pay you $25 a night at our event to walk the round card girls up and open the ring and put them back in their seat. And then you'll be our intern and you'll write press releases and do marketing and you'll understand. You'll be in every meeting. You'll be like an employee. And I took it. It gave me – I was able to translate that into 9 credits back at school. And then I took a night class when I would get off the train at night. And I worked a schedule where it was on days we didn't have to do anything in the city. And that was my foray in. And that person was a guy by the name of Steve Griffith. And Steve became a mentor to me. Actually, later on in life, had a chance. Steve went out on his own to form a PR company. And I had a chance to hire Steve and his company to work with us at the Philadelphia Soul. And he became my PR director at the Soul, his company. And I have the opportunity now at GF Sports. We have an event called Meet the Breeds, and Steve is working with us on the Meet the Breeds thing. So that's someone that I've stayed in touch with since I was 19 years old, and I could always call him up and talk about it. And that got me in. And then I realized that my side of the business was going to be the business side, the selling tickets, selling sponsorships, building a brand, marketing, and all of that. And then from there, I went to the World Wrestling Federation. I actually thought I was going to work in boxing. And another funny story, and I hope I'm not going on and on too long, but another funny story is my future wife. She's my wife. I've been with my wife since I was 17 years old. We went to high school together and college together. Her brother worked in Atlantic City for the Atlantic City Press. His assistant was a person by the name of Marie Dillon. Marie Dillon's husband was a person by the name of Bernie Dillon. Bernie Dillon was Donald Trump's right-hand man at Trump Plaza putting on boxing events. So they got me an interview, and I thought I was going into boxing in Atlantic City. And at the end of my interview, he said, I don't have a job for you. But I have a friend at the World Wrestling Federation, and would you want to do that? So I was like, I'm out of school. I'm engaged. I'm delivering beer at the Jersey Shore. My uncle ran a beer distributor, so I was delivering beer. I put in my resume. I didn't hear anything. I'm like, I really got to get on with my life here. And I called this guy and he answered the phone, and his name was Basil DeVito. And he answered the phone and he said, "We just fired somebody. Can you be here tomorrow?" And I went for an interview. And back then we didn't have cell phones. So I drove from New Jersey up to Stamford, Connecticut, found the office, went in, did an interview, drove home. And when I got home, they offered me a job to work at the World Wrestling Federation in the pay-per-view department as a pay-per-view coordinator. And that's how I started my career at the WWF and went from there.
And got to be a part of the time when Hulk Hogan was dominating the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah, I was excited. Hulk came back when I was there. I actually promoted, and I have a poster downstairs. We're cleaning out my house as we're getting ready to move. And I have a poster signed by Yokozuna and Hulk Hogan, because my first pay-per-view event that I promoted as a promoter was called King of the Ring in Dayton, Ohio, at the Irvin J. Nutter Center on the campus of Dayton. And it was Hulk Hogan's first foray back, and they signed the poster for me, and I had it framed. And then we were off and running from there. And then I did a SummerSlam event with Lex Luger. I was the promoter of the Lex Luger SummerSlam against Yokozuna. We did the Lex Express. I was the promoter for Lex body slammed Yokozuna on the deck of the Intrepid on July 4th. We did that one. We set the attendance record in the Palace at Auburn Hills for that event when he wrestled Yokozuna at SummerSlam. I did a bunch of WrestleManias. And then I rose up to be the director of pay-per-view my last year. Hurt worked up with the WWF when they went from 4 pay-per-views to 12 pay-per-views. We launched In Your House. We gave away houses. We did a lot of stuff. And then my last year there, I reported to Vince. I was kind of the marketing representative, and I would go on the road everywhere. Kevin Nash went on the road. His name was Diesel at the time. And we were going to make Diesel the next Hulk Hogan. So I traveled exclusively with Diesel for my last year there, which was exciting.
What a story of success Rich Lisk has, not only in business, but surviving. You mentioned coming from a difficult home. Mm-hmm. Do you talk to others about that?
Yeah, you know what? For many years, I didn't, and it was tough for many years growing up like that. I've been on my own since I was 18. I lived with my grandmother for a lot of years. My stepfather was very abusive. He abused me from the age of 10 till I was 18, and then at 18, I left home, and that was it. I was on my own, and for many years, I didn't talk about it. I was very closed off about it. And that's not a healthy way to live. And so as your time went on and you talk to different people and you learn about things and you kind of put into perspective that it wasn't your fault and things like that, I started to come around. And a couple of times in the past, and I haven't done it recently, I go to high schools and talk about it. And it's a different story than some others because, you know, we grew up in Union Beach. Is it Homedale? No. Is it Rumson? No. Is it those areas? No. It was lower on the socioeconomic scale, but we were a typical lower to middle class family, right? We went to Memorial School on Morningside Avenue, had 2 stepsisters and a brother. And then my parents didn't want us to go to Keyport High School, so they put us at St. John Vianney. You would have never known. Looking at my family, you would have not really known. Just the fact that I lived in Union Beach and most of my friends were in Homedale and that area, Matawan and Aberdeen, you wouldn't have thought anything. But behind closed doors, it was a nightmare, and it was a mess. So that was another thing that you hold on to a lot when you're a kid, and you hold on to that persona. It's almost like you have 2 lives. And so when I go to high schools and speak, one of the things I do like to do is go to the high schools and tell my story. And when I tell my story, I'm just like those kids sitting there. And a couple of times, and one specifically, the principal came to me at the end and he said, you know, we have some problems with some kids here and that. And one kid came up to me and I talked to him off to the side. And then I got a note from the principal saying that they got that kid out of an abusive household. And one of the things was my speech that gave him the opportunity to speak up. Because I would have never, I'd never spoke up about it. I never told anybody about it. I was a straight A student. I was a really good student. I excelled in sports and school. And I thought that would be my way out. And you know, you kind of have 2 paths. You come to a fork in the road and you could go the route that I did, or you could go drugs and alcohol and that route. And that was readily available for me to do that. And I made the conscious decision not to do it. I had some really good people that helped guide me through that, which was a godsend. And I'm happy that they did. So I do like to give back in that. I was involved and I have not been involved in a little bit of while with it, but I was involved with the Child Abuse of New Jersey Foundation. I did go out and speak to people, and I'm starting to do more of that now with some things too. So it is a story, and I want people to understand that. I want them to know that you don't have to go down that route. And there are people to talk to. I wish I did talk to people. Did I have my angry outbursts in high school and stuff like that? Absolutely, I did. And it bothered me sometimes when some of the teachers would be like, hey, he's a good student, but you know, he flipped out today. And they never really asked me why. They never really sat me down and said, is that a character for you? Why did that happen? And that's something I want to get across to people too, that again, looking at us, you wouldn't have thought what was behind those doors. And everyone's different. So take the time to ask those questions. If it's not right, take the time to look at it and poke around a little bit. And maybe if someone would have poked around, that I might have opened up earlier and not had some of the things that have happened to me throughout the years. But the one thing I will say, it all comes back to sports. Like, sports was sports. There was nothing that made me feel better than being on a field and being away from that. Though, when I stepped on that baseball field, those lines were like walls. Nobody could touch me on those fields. So you would always find me on a field somewhere playing. I had a built-in family with my teammates. I had camaraderie. I had respect. That was a big deal. Like, kids that are abused lack that respect, and I didn't have that respect in my house, but I had it on the field, and I played hard, and I stuck up for my teammates. And things like that. And that meant a lot to me. And to me, that's a microcosm of what a family should be. And I think that's why I gravitated towards it so much.
Finding more out about Rich Liss, you have to think that your wife, Terry, has to be a special lady.
Oh, she's a saint. She's a saint. Yeah, she is a very special lady. Her family's special. Her father was a huge athlete in Mattawan, so I had that connection with them. They've grew up in Mattawan, lived in Mattawan their whole lives. He still holds records at Mattawan High School. So that family took me in, and they've been tremendous to me. And my wife, she's a saint. That's all I can say. She's a saint. Believe me, I probably wasn't the easiest person to deal with growing up as an adolescent or even as an adult and at times, but she's a saint.
Your three children, Bump, Gabrielle, and Ryan. Bump is playing Division III hockey, huh?
Just finished up. Yeah, he just finished up. He had a goal in life to play college hockey, and he fulfilled that goal and that dream. He's always been a driven kid. He's always been the kid that was the overachiever, and when people would say, oh, you're too small to play defense, or you're not fast enough to do this, or you're not strong enough to do this, his goal was to prove people wrong, and he did it. And I give him a lot of credit, and I have a lot of respect for how he handles himself as a young man, and how he has grown up, and how he sees the world, and his work ethic is tremendous, and again, I love the fact that a kid at such a young age had a dream. And his dream was to play college hockey. And he could have played probably, you know, low-level Division I, in and out of the lineup type thing. But he looked at it from a standpoint of saying, where's going to get – am I going to get my best education? They allowed him to play lacrosse too. So he was a two-sport athlete his first year, which was appealing to him. And he played 100-plus games of college hockey and was they won two championships while he was there, and he was excited. So I'm glad that it's good when I talk to kids too, that's a route also, because a lot of kids, I'm going to play Division I hockey, I'm going to play Division I football and stuff. There's a lot of opportunities in other divisions, and he met his girlfriend there, and who knows, you know, knock on wood, we'll see how that goes. And he's coming out of there, and the school that he went to is called Endicott. They made him do three internships to graduate, and he's going to be in the finance world, and he's ahead of the curve, and he's accomplished everything he wanted to accomplish, which was great.
So Gabrielle and Ryan are both in their early 20s.
Yeah.
When did you have the difficult conversation with them about what took place in your household when you were growing up?
You know what? We waited till they started asking some questions. I'm estranged from my mother and my brother. I have not seen them in 22 years. So obviously questions start to arise. We waited till they were mature enough to understand it. We waited till they started asking questions that showed us that they were mature enough to understand it. And then that's when it happened. And with each kid, that happens at different ages. So there wasn't like one specific age that my wife and I said, okay, at age 13, we're going to sit them down and talk to them. Gabrielle is an old soul. Gabrielle is a wise person. She's mature way beyond her years. And she took to it a little bit earlier and wanted to know more than the boys. And I think that father-daughter relationship that we have, she's my only daughter, and she's the apple of my eye with being my daughter and stuff. I think that helped bridge that gap a little bit more. She's very analytical. She's very smart. She gets it. She sees it on that level. She's always gravitated towards adults, even as a kid. So I think when we sat down to talk to her, she saw it at a different level. A different level of that. She wanted to know why. She wanted to know how I felt. She wanted to know how I handled it. And then sometimes when you talk to the boys, they get angry about it. And that's more of their personality with it. So we took it in stages. And when they were ready to talk about it, we talked about it. But I will say Gabrielle, out of all of them, did it at a much earlier age. And I think it's way because she is so wise and beyond her years with an old soul.
Quite a story, Rich. And when you see that all the success that you have had, you know, since that time, it's a tribute to you and your family. When it comes to this move that you have now, how does that work out with all the kids? Everybody is old enough now to understand, you know, picking up and moving to Long Island. Everybody on board with that?
You know, it's fun. That's a good question to ask, and a lot of people don't ask you that when you're moving, right? They just say, "Are you ready to go?" and stuff. And listen, Bump is going to move on and get his job and his girlfriend, and again, knock on wood, that goes to the next level, and they're going to start their life. And my daughter, Gabrielle, like we talked about, she's a wise old soul, and she only wants her life to be in New York City. She went to school in New York City. She went to one school, walked into that school and said, this is the school that fits for me. I'm going to live in Brooklyn, and this is my life. So she's going to be in New York City. And she's now in the process of getting a job and being in the psychology world, and she'll go back and get her master's and be a psychologist down the road and psychiatrist, and she'll be in New York City. So Long Island to her it's New York. So that's a good thing. Ryan, my youngest, he's still with us, right? He's still living at home. So that was someone that we wanted to make sure he was okay with, taking him out of his room that he's known in his neighborhood and his friends. And out of all my kids, Ryan is probably the closest in personality to me. He's in his own right, a great athlete. We used to joke around all the time and say that Ryan had more physical ability than Bump. Bump worked harder, but Ryan could go out and score 4 goals and 5 goals in hockey and then be like, okay, where are we going out for dinner, or let's start playing video games. And the kid just had it and still does, and does it on his own terms. But again, very mature. He made the decision to go to Bentley University and do that and be a finance major. So when we sat with Ryan to talk to him about the move, yeah, I mean, I think he felt it a little bit, but understood it. And then he starts turning into, you know, the 19-20-year-old. Well, I got a lot of friends that live on Long Island, and I can get rides home, and oh, this is nice, and the beach is close, and they all love the teams and stuff that I'm with, so they follow it and things. So I think it's going to work out. I think it's going to work out well, because on the caveat on the back end, you know, we all are from New Jersey. And I could see when I retire that it'll be at the Jersey Shore at some spot. I love the Jersey Shore. I love everything about it. And we will end up at the Jersey Shore. So in the back of their mind, they know that we're going there for a little bit, but we'll be back in Jersey.
Well, I stood stone-like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade. And I combed my hair till it was just right, and commanded the night brigade. I was hoping the plane had crossed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch. I strolled all along to a fallout zone, came out with my soul untouched. I hid in the cloud and wrath of the crowd when they stared. said sit down, I stood up.
Speaking of the Jersey Shore, I know you are a fan of some of the legendary musicians that have come from the area. You probably don't know that little Steven Van Zandt, is a huge fan of WBGO and the morning show with Gary Walker, and I do the news with Gary in the morning, and that Max Weinberg also listens to the station on a regularity. I know that Bruce Springsteen is a big part of your music collection.
Oh, he is... And I, you know, that was originally growing up. My wife was a big Springsteen fan, and I will say this is a big bone of contention in our house. When I started growing up and I was developing myself, I probably leaned more towards the Bon Jovi hard rock metal band a little bit more than my wife was into Springsteen. I wanted to impress her when I was a young kid, so I learned every song, every word to Greetings from Asbury Park. And so when we went on a date, I could at least talk about that because I knew we were in high school together and her friends told me she loves Bruce Springsteen and Southside Johnny. So that album is my favorite all-time album. My favorite song is Lost in the Flood. I've seen him 36 times. I've seen him at the Shore a bunch of times at some bars, actually the bar in Long Branch that burnt down. We saw him one night. A tie back to my wrestling days, when Bam Bam Bigelow retired, he became a bodyguard for Bruce. And we went and saw Clarence Clemons one night, and Bruce was there, and I saw Bam Bam, and I walked up, and we had the connection because I was from Jersey, and he was from Jersey. And I did WrestleMania 10 with him when he fought Lawrence Taylor. And I said, Bammer, what are you doing here? He goes, I'm bouncing for Bruce. I go, man, the dream of mine would be to meet Bruce and stuff. He goes, all right, Rich, when we get done, we're going to walk through the bar. Walk towards me. I'll step to the side. You walk in and shake his hand. And I said, all right. And Bruce walked through Stone Pony, and I walked up. Bam looked at me and winked, and he turned to the side, and I walked in. Hey, Bruce, how are you? Nice to meet you. And shook his hand and stuff. So that was a big thing. And I love it. I mean, when I was the GM of the Trenton Titans, I had the Smithereens actually open up the arena for us and sing the national anthem. That was our first national anthem we ever had, was the Smithereens. And then I had Pat DiNunzio come back and do it. And then we had La Bamba come and do it on the trumpet once. So any Jersey Shore music my son grew up with and played hockey, and I helped coach one of the guys down the shore, Bobby Mahoney. Bobby's now playing a lot down the shore, and that was his passion. So any chance I get, my wife and I cut down to Asbury and hit the German Beer Hall and hit the Stone Pony and all the places and love that music. That's my heart.
And everybody's wrecked on Main Street from drinking unholy blood. Sticker smile sweet as Gunner breathes deep, his ankles caked in mud. And I said, hey, Gunner, man, that's quicksand. That's quicksand, that ain't mud. Have you thrown your sounds to the war? Did you lose them in the flood?
You know, at some point, Rich, you and I have to meet face to face after this social distancing, because we have so many people in common. We had talked before we went on the air about Bobby Amonte, who for a long time owned a bar restaurant in Union Beach. But you mentioned Bam Bam Bigelow. You definitely don't know this one. I was actually related through marriage to Bam Bam Bigelow for a while.
Really?
My first wife, and I stress first, her cousin was Bam Bam Bigelow, and I attended Bam Bam's son's first birthday.
Oh, my God. It's a small world. That's a small, small world.
And I want to tell you, he was the biggest kid I had ever seen.
That comes from Bam Bam. He was a good guy, Bam Bam, and I know he left a little early in life. And stuff. But again, for being from New Jersey, there wasn't many wrestlers from New Jersey. B. Brian Blair was a huge Springsteen fan, so he and I used to talk all the time about Springsteen, exchange VHS tapes and things. And then Bam Bam, being from Point Pleasant, he and I had a lot of conversations and traveled together and things. And he was always proud of his Jersey Shore roots, which I'm very proud of too. So we always hit it off. He's a good guy.
From Grenoble in the French Alps, weighing 520 pounds, the eighth wonder of the world, Andre the Giant. And his opponent, from Asbury Park, New Jersey, weighing 393 pounds,
we got a man over here with tattoos on his head. I mean, just not one tattoo, but flames coming all the top across of his skull. You understand what I'm talking about? That man weighs over 400 pounds, I'm sure.
Final question for you on Sports Jam is, when you receive the 2016 General Manager of the Year for your work with the New England Black Wolves of the National Lacrosse League, what did that mean to you?
It was huge. It was a big accomplishment in my career. I've won two championships, one with the East Coast Hockey League and one with the Philadelphia Soul. But that one, that meant a lot to me for a couple of reasons. And one, when we started the Black Wolves, we got sold from Philadelphia to New England. We had 10 weeks to put it together. And that was, when I say put it together, that means buying the boards, buying the glass, putting uniforms on. We had a few players, and we did it, and we won the first two games, and everyone thought I was a genius. And then we went 2-14 down the stretch and ended the season 4-14. So that was my first kind of like, okay, we got to take a step back and evaluate. And I sat with the owners, Mike French and Brad Brewster, and we sat with Mohegan, and we went through what do we need to do. And we put a plan in place, and we hired a coach by the name of Glenn Clark. And Glenn and I sat down. I did not know Glenn from Adam, and Mike French, our owner, did and highly recommended him. So Glenn and I sat down, and we came up with a five-year plan. And the first step of that five-year plan was to get us to the playoffs. We had to bite off what we could bite off right away and get us to the playoffs. And Glenn and I became really close and good friends starting there. So now my work goes to – now I have to go to work. And that was my first year of being kind of taking over the reins of a new team in a way, right? Because we had 10 weeks to get there. We already had a team. Like, we pretty much cleared house and started over. And I made a big trade. I had two trades going at the time. I was trading to get a player back that we had in Philadelphia named Kevin Crowley, who was a big-time scorer. And I was trading to get a guy named Sean Evans, who was the reigning MVP of the league. And I was working these two trades simultaneously because I didn't want both teams to know, because then one would ask for more or pull one off the table. So I was able to pull the Kevin Crowley deal off pretty quickly and get that in the mix. And then a week later, I was able to pull off Sean Evans and getting that trade done. And then I picked up a couple of free agents that really fit into what we had. Cause when we were making these deals and stuff, we didn't have any picks and we didn't have a lot of assets. Not many people want players from a 4-14 team. So we were able to put those pieces together. And then Glenn and I sat again and said, okay, now here's the personnel I've gotten you. Here's the plan we put in place for 5 years. What do we need to get it to those 2 points? And we put that together. And then that year we went from 4-14 to 10-8. Glenn won coach of the year. I won the IL Indoor GM of the year. And it felt great because we were establishing something in New England for the first time, which was great. And the fans really took to it. And we made it to the playoffs. And at that playoffs, we won the first round. And the two parts that really come to me was we were going into overtime in the one playoff game against Georgia, who would eventually go on in the next couple of years and win a championship. And the crowd started chanting on their own, "Let's go Black Wolves." And that was a huge accomplishment, I thought, for the franchise. But also I took a step back and soaked it in, because I think at times when you're in sports, you don't soak in certain moments. And that was one of the moments I soaked in. And we wound up beating them in overtime with Sean Evans scoring the goal to get us there. And we went to the Eastern Division Finals and eventually lost to Buffalo. And that was a huge part. And then being an American in a Canadian sport, really, it's predominantly Canadian. At the time, I think I was the only American GM. Breaking into that fraternity and establishing relationships and putting a team like the Black Wolves on the map and stuff like that was huge when that award came down the pike, because it helped cement some things, and it helped really kick off the five-year plan that Glenn and I put in place for that team. And when I left them in great hands, and they're in a great spot, and they're 8-3, and they're the best team in the league right now. And if and when this league comes back, they'll be one of the teams fighting for a championship. And that, if they win the championship, that would be the culmination of our five-year plan. And that would be a great thing.
So I lied. One more question.
Go ahead. I could talk all day. I'm Italian from Jersey. I just do nothing but talk.
I have listened and watched you talk a lot about the draft process, you know, especially in the National Lacrosse League, but I know you've done it for other sports. So here's one of those type of questions that you may need to think about for a moment, but there is a new sport that you're now the VP of or the general manager of. We don't know really what the sport is, but we know the players who are available for the draft. And those happen to be Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Tom Brady, Joe Namath, Mike Trout, Derek Jeter, Connor McDavid, or Sidney Crosby. Who are you taking number one and why?
I would no doubt take Michael Jordan number one. And we have this argument in our house. There's two athletes in my house that we argue about, and I think they argue with me more just to get under my skin. Michael Jordan is one of them because I had the opportunity to live through his years and see him growing up, me growing up and him playing. And what he did, not just for the team on the floor, what he did for pop culture, what he did for an industry with sneakers, what he did for a company like Nike, all of that combined in. And the other thing I'll say is the man's been to six championships and he's won six championships. He's taken a team on its back. That team, people say, oh, you know, well, it was the Bulls. Yes, but they had different iterations of the Bulls too. He had different people playing with him. Really, the constants with that team was him and Scottie Pippen, and the other pieces changed around him at times. So to me, overall package of what he could do for a franchise, Michael Jordan. And if I had 1A, it would be Derek Jeter. And I would tell you why with Derek Jeter, because I don't know how a man for 20 years in New York City as the captain of a storied franchise, he's won five championships, never once won an MVP, and has won five championships. To me, that's the ultimate captain. Never on the front page, never on the back page of a newspaper. Consummate professional, handled himself the right way, actually works and underneath the Jordan brand, which is kind of odd, the two of them together. But for what he did on that stage in New York City and never won an MVP, and people like an Alex Rodriguez, who never won a championship but won a lot of MVPs, had to come and play with him to get a championship. Give me two picks and I'll take those two guys and I'll be okay.
Rich List, the executive VP of the New York Riptide of the National Lacrosse League and GF Sports, the live events and sports media entertainment company. You have to promise me that we're going to meet at some point and to continue our conversation. But for now, continued success with not only your family and keep safe during this unbelievable time, and success with the New York Riptide when the season begins anew. And thanks so much for your time on Sports Jam.
I appreciate it. Two things, I'll promise. I'll stop at Iberia and we'll have drinks and dinner, and you'll be at a Riptide game. And we'll sit at a Riptide game and watch a game together.
I'll hold you to it. Thanks so much.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can catch all the shows at WBGO.org/SportsJam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll hopefully see you at the game soon.